The Tom Woods Show, episode 436.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Very pleased to welcome back to the show, James Bovard. James Bovard is an investigative journalist, a great libertarian, the author of 10 books, and in particular, we want to talk today about his wonderful book, Public Policy Hooligan, Rollicking and Wrangling from Helltown to Washington. Here is not only the story of how James Bovard became James Bovard, but also all the stories of his fights against all these government bureaucracies. They can't stand him. He's been singled out by name, by agency after agency, which proves he's doing his job as an investigative journalist. What a rare thing. And so I'm really, really pleased to be able to talk to him about that today. Before I get to James Bovard, I want to thank you guys once again for helping the show by making your Amazon purchases through the Amazon widget that you'll find at tomwoods.com and on all the show notes pages, like today is tomwoods.com/436, where, by the way, you can find Public Policy Hooligan linked there. But entering Amazon through one of those links or through the Amazon widget there at no cost to yourself, you are helping me keep the lights on here, basically. I mean, you all know I have 5 kids. I can't be out of pocket with the show. And you're making it possible for me to have an office to do this in, to have a producer who assists me doing indispensable work. This all makes the show possible. So I give the show, and we all enjoy doing it. I produce one every weekday, and you guys have helped keep it going so that my expenses are covered and I'm able to keep on doing it. And I'm deeply grateful to you for that and for remembering me when you're about to make those Amazon purchases. Okay, now let's turn to James Bovard. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me back on.
We had you on pretty recently, but I wanted to have you back because of your book, Public Policy Hooligan, that looks back on your career, but not just on your career as a journalist, a muckraking journalist in the best tradition, raking the muck where it really is to be found in the corridors of government. But it also tells your personal story. And so often in our formative years, this is when we become the people we are in terms of our ideological outlook. And when I read your story, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about your family, your background, any work that you did. I didn't know any of this stuff, and I found it very interesting to read about. So before we get into some of the issues that you tackled over the years as a journalist, let's think back to as you were growing up. Tell me a couple of things that happened to you that gave you a jaundiced view of our wise public servants.
Well, there were lots of experiences early on. Hey, thanks very much for having me on, giving me a chance to talk about the book. I really appreciate that, Tom.
My pleasure.
One of the first experiences was I worked for the Virginia Highway Department one summer when I was 16, 17, and spent out there working with the government employees. That was where I learned how not to shovel.
Okay.
And it was fascinating just to see the attitude towards labor, because these were folks who were just kind of like, you know, there was a way to lean on a shovel where you don't look like you're completely lazy, where you look like you're getting ready to work. And the most important lesson which I was taught was two things. One, to never be caught with both my hands in my pocket, and two, to never be caught sitting down by the county supervisor. But aside from that, you know, I didn't sweat very much in that job. But there was a mindset there. There were some really nice guys who I was working with, you know, fun to shoot the bull with. I mean, they were not all obscene in their humor. Not to say that I was a choir boy on that, but, there was an attitude towards work where they were basically just killing time. Okay, well, you know, 5 o'clock coming around, let's just kind of shuffle along here. And yeah, I guess it's time to go back to the headquarters and check out. So whereas I was working a private job at that point, I was working in a book bindery where I'd go in once a week and unload trucks. And that paid a lot better. It was a flat fee, basically tax-free. But there the whole focus was to get the job done as fast as possible and get out of there. And it just encouraged a whole different attitude towards life. And I could see that the government employee mindset, aside from being not very productive, would just kind of could tend to drag a person down through life.
I want to get on the recording here, the episode near the 7-Eleven.
All right.
I won't say anything about it. I want you to tell that story.
Okay. Let me pull this up here. Okay.
Because that would have formed me. I would have looked at the police very, very differently for the rest of my life after an episode like that.
Well, okay. How should I start this out? I mean,
well, they were accusing you of all kinds of crazy things that you had no intention of doing.
That's true. That's true. So a second episode that had a formula influence. I was wheeling and dealing in rare coins from the time I was in junior high. And it was a bull market time for rare coins, so it was a little bit difficult to lose money that way. But I was buying and selling from different dealers across the country, and I would sometimes go to coin shows. And around Thanksgiving 1973, I borrowed my family car and drove up 300 miles to the Washington, D.C. area for a big coin show. And I got there early, and I was kind of, it would have been expensive to get a motel room. So the thing I figured I'd do, like I'd done sometimes before, I'd just kind of sleep in the back of the Ford Pinto that I was driving, just, you know, flop it down, take it easy there. Since I had like $1,000 worth of rare coins with me at that point, I had a track starter pistol with me that I just kind of left on the front seat. And later on, when I was crashing out, I had it on the floor of the vehicle, and I just didn't think, just in case someone wants to bother me, you know, the person might see that and go away. Well, apparently someone, I was trying to find a good place to crash out, so I ended up parking next to a 7-Eleven because it was well-lit and heavily trafficked. Not the smartest thing I ever did, but what the heck? A little while later, I noticed a police car pulling into the parking lot with flashing lights. So I figured, well, you know, maybe someone was jaywalking nearby, and on the nearby Jefferson Davis Highway. A couple minutes later, a second police car pulled in. There were four policemen were huddled outside the first car. Perhaps these guys had seen two jaywalkers. So this tall, brown-haired young cop comes over, knocks on my front window. He says, "Can I see some ID?" I said, "Yeah, sure." So I handed it to him, and so the cop starts going over the interior of my car with his, you know, powerful flashlight. He fixates for several seconds on that starter pistol that was laying on the floor next to a couple paper bags. And so the cop asked if I have a firearm. I said, "No, I've got a track starter pistol. That's what you just shined your light on." And he says, "Step out of the car." I said, "Well, okay." So I stepped out, and he says, "Sir, you're under arrest for concealing a deadly weapon." I said, "Bullshit. It's not a weapon. It wasn't concealed. It's something that you saw before you even asked about." He says, "It was concealed. That's a crime." I said, "You saw it." He says, "You have the right to remain silent," so on and so forth. So he pulls out the handcuffs, and, it might have been BS, but I was outnumbered 4-1, and those guys had real guns. So I was frisked and shoved in the back of the car. The tow truck comes up and beelines from my car. I told the police to make sure that my stash of coins got out of there before it was towed away. So I was cuffed and stuffed and driven to the police station. And somewhere along the way, there was a bureaucratic miracle. It was like the Bible story, water turning into wine. Instead of a starter pistol just laying on the floor, at some point that starter pistol got hid inside of two bags. And that was the kind of transubstantiation which changed a few paltry facts into sinister criminal behavior. Instead of a dim-witted country kid bumbling within city limits, which I was, the cops could pretend that they had grabbed a hitman waiting to wreak late-night havoc at 7-Eleven.
Yeah, because a lot of hitmen you want to hire fall asleep with the gun visible, you know?
And I was 17 at the point, so it's like, you know, what is this stuff? And so, as the story went along, the cops actually accused me of robbing that 7-Eleven. And I was thinking, so I was sitting, I was outside, you know, trying to sleep. Was I using ESP to try to steal the cash register or what? Now, it was interesting. I not had much experience at that point in life with dealing with adults who were just completely brazen liars. But that's what the cop who arrested me was. That's what the police and superintendent who spent the next 3 hours basically browbeating me, trying to get me to confess. Hour after hour, I guess probably to about 3 o'clock in the morning. And they were just kind of, and those guys needed a confession because they didn't have squat. They had, okay, so there was a starter pistol and, you know, I was in the car. And so what? But apparently there'd been another 7-Eleven robbed somewhere nearby that night. And I said to these guys, okay, was the other robber, you know, almost 6 feet tall and burly and red-haired? Well, we don't know. I mean, if you don't know that, if you can't get a basic ID, but it was interesting for the to go through the browbeating, to be accused of crime after crime. First of all, they were the cops accused me of robbing another 7-Eleven store early that evening. I was accused of stealing the starter pistol. I was accused of stealing the blank caps for the gun. The cops must have thought I was cheap. The cops accused me of running away from home and stealing the family car. Was the vehicle reported as stolen? I don't think so. They accused me of stealing the coins I had with me. I had various receipts I showed that maybe they thought they were elaborate forgeries, or maybe the cops didn't read so good. And the final offense, which compounded all the other crimes, was I was guilty of perjury. And I said, well, how am I guilty of perjury? Well, you're guilty of perjury because you won't confess to all these other things. And I'm thinking like, I was dumb to have that on the floor of the car, but I wasn't stupid enough to confess. And thanks to that, those cops eventually had to, they had to recognize that they had no right to hold me, though I was stuck in a juvenile center for about for the rest of the night and part of the next day until my parents would come and sign me out. And I think if I'd known the right phrases, the right legal phrases, I could have gotten out sooner, but I didn't. But it was a very educational experience, you know. But I learned from that, and that was the last time that I ever slept next to a 7-Eleven.
Yeah, I was going to say that would be one of the lessons that you would certainly take away from this. I want to talk about some of your journalistic work over the years, particularly because there was an item in the news the other day about the actor Hugh Jackman, who apparently is trying to do philanthropic work. And I don't want to make fun of people who are doing what they think to be right in what they think to be a good cause. So he was somewhere in Africa, and he's trying to help people there. And I thought, well, if he really wants to help people, I'm sure he's favoring spreading the market economy all over the world. So I read the article, you know, more or less knowing what to expect. But I have to admit, he did, you know, there were things like the purpose of our program is not to get people dependent on it, but to get things started and then leave them on their own 2 feet. So I thought, all right, well, that's a pretty good start. And then he talked about the miracles that could take place if we would just pay a little bit more for coffee, if we would pay fair trade rates for coffee, then we'd have all these issues. So in other words, as long as we're extremely patronizing toward these people and we make our purchases on the basis of something other than we make all of our other purchases, then things will be fine. So there's something screwy about that. And I know you wrote a book called Fair Trade Fraud, and you talk about it in this book, Public Policy Hooligan. What's your initial response to a claim like that?
These are folks who think that their own good intentions are morally superior to the law of supply and demand, voluntary marketplace interactions. There was a study which I saw that talked about fair trade coffee, and it turned out that apparently that the fair trade, that the coffee which is labeled fair trade, is actually lower quality than a lot of the coffee produced in the same areas, which is not sold under a fair trade label, because the farmers apparently know that, well, you know, the folks who are buying on fair trade basis will take anything. Whereas if they're going for some private sale, it needs to be good quality. So the folks who act like they're doing this notion of fair trade, they're getting shafted on price and quality. But I'm fascinated by this whole notion of fair trade, and it was something which I started writing about in the mid 1980s, and I was curious that folks would have faith that the politicians setting prices would be fairer than the voluntary agreements of buyers and sellers, and it doesn't matter what side of a national border that they're on. But the whole idea of these trade barriers, and it was throughout American history, it had a significant influence in causing the American Civil War. But these folks who want to put politicians on a pedestal and act like they have the wisdom and the decency to dictate prices, because that is what trade barriers do. Trade barriers allow politicians to take consumers hostage.
But isn't it the case that if only this particular person Hugh Jackman is pointing to could get a fair shake, if only he could get a start, then his life would be vastly improved. But all we do is look for cheap prices. Isn't that short-sighted and selfish on our part? Shouldn't we want to help these brand-new producers in these less developed countries?
Well, if you look at the history of the Third World, the farmers throughout the Third World in many areas have thrived wonderfully in places where the government is not shafting them. In so many places, much of the worst suffering in the last 60 years has been in Africa, and that's also the place where the governments have been most idiotic and predatory. The World Bank and sometimes U.S. Foreign aid agencies would bankroll these farm boards, which had a monopoly over the farmers, and would set prices at an artificially unfair low rates that would bankrupt farmers and help lead to famine. And the governments bankrolled by us and World Bank have had so many other stupid policies. One of my favorite ones was there was a country in Africa in the mid-80s which had a tariff of, I think, 63% on used tractors. Now, this is a country that had a lot of good farmland, arable farmland. It was not being plowed. It was only being plowed once a year instead of twice or three times, but they were keeping out the tractors. And so you're dealing with a group of politicians who are almost stupid or predatory beyond belief, and U.S. policy has propped them up. And what's happened with some of these voluntary, these non-government entities that go abroad, many of them have also propped up governments who are the worst enemies of the farmers and of everybody else in that country.
I would think, by the way, also that if I'm suddenly buying coffee from some fair trade producer, that I'm overlooking the really numberless people who just haven't gone through the bureaucratic hoops to get the official fair trade designation, who are just as worthy of my consumer dollar, who are just as destitute, just as much in need of it, but just through the arbitrariness of politics don't have the official gold star seal of approval.
Absolutely. And I'm very distrustful of any situation which gives some people the arbitrary power to dictate that some price or some group or some entity is fair. Because fairness should be based on the voluntary agreement of the buyer and the seller. And as soon as you have something else aside from that, you're going to have a lot of corruption, and there's going to be exploitation and abuse. And that's the history of trying to patronize third world farmers. I mean, the thing which we should have done, and we've done a little bit of it, simply open our markets to third world agriculture products. That's far more help to third world farmers than any handout from the U.S. government or from private voluntary groups.
Let's talk about the Department of Labor and some of your work over there. It was, I guess, back in the 1980s that we had, early 1980s, that we had the CETA program. It must have been, I don't remember what it stood for, but it had something to do with employment training. And it was a job training program, something like that.
Yeah, well, it was a job training and government make-work job creation program.
That's what. So you could create jobs through this
right.
program, and then different politicians would say, "Look at how many jobs I brought to my district through this CETA."
That's it, CETA. Yep, CETA was famous for boosting employment, but they just they were much more effective at making jobs than at getting people to work. But that's typical for government job creation. It's an absolute boondoggle. It was a squandering of vast amount of resources. They were so proud of the dumb things which they did to create jobs, such as out in Oregon, I think that they built an artificial rock for rock climbers to practice on. They were going door to door to sign up people for food stamps. There were a lot of other programs, and what they did in many places simply boost the number of employees on local government payrolls. But there was a study which came out a few years after the program was replaced by some other federal boondoggle, and the study found that people that enrolled in CETA had lower subsequent earnings than people who were never on the government payroll. And this is part of the same pattern that's continued since then, that you have all these government job programs and all these politicians boasting about the good they're doing, but overall it has a net, it harms the lives of the trainees.
I remember a passage in one of my favorite books by Thomas Sowell, Civil Rights, Rhetoric, or Reality, when he points out that a typical civil rights leader will point to 100 jobs that were brought to his area by CETA, but the fact is, if you got rid of occupational licensing in a particular area or you abolished the taxi medallion system in New York, you would do vastly more for, let's say, black employment than you could possibly do with your 100 miserable jobs. But those jobs are earmarked, they're public, we can see that the cause of them was the government, and it's a feather in the civil rights leader's cap. But it's no feather in his cap to do something that's of just general benefit to the downtrodden. And particularly because it won't be immediately obvious what the consequences are, because it's part of the so-called unseen effects of repealing a government program. So this sort of program grows despite its total lack of effectiveness. It's like the Job Corps. The Job Corps' effectiveness is practically nil. Very, very few people who go through it wind up getting a job in that field. They generally have wages that are no higher than people who didn't go through the program at all, didn't show up for the program. And yet these things go on. I once naively, back in my academic days, I had a student naively ask me, well, if this program doesn't work, why does it still exist? Why does a program still exist, Jim Bovard, if it doesn't work?
Well, it's a question of how you define doesn't work, because,
yeah,
okay,
the work for whom?
Yeah, well, you know, these job training programs have not worked out well for the trainees, but they've been great for the politicians. They've been great for a lot of the contractors who run their programs, who make donations to politicians, or the government social service agencies, which get a vast number of new people on the dole from these programs. It's interesting, the summer job programs, which started in the Great Society, are still going on in some places. This is a wonderful example of what happens when the government decides to give people, teenagers, a step up in the world. What happens instead is that folks, the government often ruins people's work ethic. And this was pointed out almost 50 years ago by the General Accounting Office, which said the summer jobs cause youth to get a false notion of what can be of what people get wages for, because in D.C. they just show up and they get a paycheck. I did an investigation for Reader's Digest on this in the late 1980s. I was going around looking at some of the programs, and my favorite summer jobs program was something called the Marion Barry Youth Leadership Institute. And it was named after the mayor.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, named after the mayor. And at this point, the mayor had only had about 38 different corruption scandals linked to him. He was never convicted for corruption. He was convicted for other things. But, you know, just an utterly tainted son-of-a-gun weasel. And since he's dead, he can't sue me for libel. But the folks at Labor Department, the U.S. Labor Department, bankrolled this Marion Barry Youth Leadership Institute, which was also very, very, very clearly linked to some of the stuff that Barry's reelection campaign did. And it's like, it was bizarre that, and I went there and they just had all these kids sitting around in groups just kind of shooting the bull. And I think a big topic of that day was whether or not girls enjoyed sex. And I'm thinking, okay, what kind of jobs are they training them for?
Unbelievable. You know, by the way, before we go on, there's one other program that might seem trivial to my listeners, but it matters to me because as I was growing up and becoming politically aware, I mean, I first really got interested in politics, let's say, around age 12. And then by age 16, I was very interested in it. So age 16 was the 1988 election, and
oh,
George H.W. Bush, yeah, he had chosen Dan Quayle. as his running mate. Now, you, as a specialist in labor policy, will know where this is going. I distinctly remember Dan Quayle, this undistinguished senator from Indiana, pointing to the Job Training Partnership Act as one of his great legislative achievements, and he was so happy that he'd been able to reach across the aisle and collaborate with Ted Kennedy on this. And, of course, that should have made you think this can't possibly be any good. When did Ted Kennedy do anything for the free market? But he touted this and touted this, so it was like a blast from the past, reading your book, to come across the Job Training Partnership Act. I never read anything about it at the time as to whether it was any good. I just assumed it was a boondoggle. But it turns out it really wasn't so good.
Well, that's putting it mildly. Yeah, I had some fun with that. A number of folks from the Labor Department had very vehement attacks on my writing on this. But there was a story which I did shortly after Quayle was nominated for vice president. I did the piece for the New Republic, a piece called Quayle's Egg, which looked at the record of this Job Training Partnership Act in Quayle's own state of Indiana, showing there was basically a bunch of welfare for corporations and government agencies. The folks on Capitol Hill were upset by that article. Somebody asked the inspector general to investigate my allegations. The IG report came back and confirmed almost everything I'd said, though it did quibble with the exact cost of a few outlays. Now, and so after that, the Reader's Digest wanted me to do an investigation, so I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Labor Department. They basically told me to, take a long walk on a short pier in spite of the law, which says that they have to be, give this information out. So, and I was the folks at Labor Department, at the Employment and Training Administration, I knew that they hated me because I'd written about them many times, and they were just, I just had the sense that they were biased against me. And so when I did, Reader's Digest wanted me to interview the Secretary of Labor, Elizabeth Dole. So instead of going through the Employment Training Office, I just called her office directly, and, there was some funny back and forth, and they first said, yeah, okay, sure, come on and interview her. And then they said, well, maybe we'll just do it by phone. And so I said, well, if we do it by phone, Mrs. Dole's picture might not get in the article of Reader's Digest. So they said, well, okay, come on in. And it was a funny experience. Me and the managing editor of Reader's Digest, Bill Schultz, went there to interview her. And she'd been in politics for more than 20 years at that point. And she was all dolled up, and she greeted us like we were visiting the throne of a small European kingdom. The interview was set for 30 minutes, so she starts talking nonstop. And she literally talked for about 16 minutes without breathing. And it occurred to me that, it's going to be impossible to get any information because she was just doing her talking points. So and finally, I just jumped in and said, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but, okay, for instance, there was this boondoggle program out in California. Why did JTBA finance that? And she just stops and stares. And then the Digest editor asked a question, and then she and I started going back. He and I started, doing a back and forth series of questions. And she didn't know anything about the program except the talking points. So after about 10 minutes of this, she finally said, "Well, I think you want to talk to the employment and training branch." So she kind of kicked us out of the office. And as soon as we got out of her secretarial suite, the press secretary, her press secretary, had been interviewed. She had been sitting next to me, and I was kind of concerned because her knees were shaking, literally, and I was afraid she was going to pass out. But as soon as we got out in the hallway, it was funny because this woman just started screaming and shouting, "I can't believe you've done that!" Like we'd violated the secretary's dignity. But my favorite part of the story is I found out a year afterwards that just after we'd left, the press secretary called over to the employment training branch and said, "Okay, there's a problem here. The Secretary Dole was just interviewed by someone who asked a lot of difficult questions." And so the people there said, "Well, who was it?" And they said, "Well, this Bovard guy." They said, "You let him speak to the secretary? Are you nuts?" So anyhow,
that's a compliment. That is a real compliment.
Well, I was, folks out there would have loved to see me skinned. So. And I had a lot of back and forth with them. And it's funny, once the Reader's Digest article came out, the folks in the secretary's office made a huge push to try and destroy the credibility. They were leaking documents and sending around these memos. But, you know, the program was a boondoggle, and eventually even Congress admitted that.
Before I let you go, there's so many things in this book, by the way, Public Policy Hooligan. You guys would love reading it. And by the way, it's great summer reading because not only do you learn a lot, but of course, with Jim Bovard writing it, the prose just sparkles, the stories jump off the page. It's not just a book about public policy. It's a book about this particular person uncovering all these horrifying episodes. So it's very, very interesting to read. There's one other item I want to make mention of. It's from your discussion of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, just the stuff, and I know this is controversial, but that's why I'm bringing it up, just the stuff about Section 8 rental subsidies. Now, this doesn't sound like any big deal. Okay, rental subsidies, who cares? But this turns out to be a big, big problem. You wrote a 9,000-word American Spectator article about it. There was a spinoff from it that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. What exactly was this? I've got this quotation from that at that time, the HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros, saying that America is a society divided spatially, which is, as you note in your book, is a strange way of putting things. What does that mean? We don't all live in the same house. Obviously, yeah. We're divided spatially. But then he says his fair housing czar, believe there was such a thing, Roberta Achtenberg, said to NPR, "We are compelled by statutory prescription as well as constitutional mandate to see to it that every American has open and free housing choice." Well, okay. I mean, I guess they're all free market people because that's what we're all about, is open and free housing choice. But it turns out this is not really a free market program, Jim Bovard. I'm disappointed once again. What does it turn out to be?
Well, it's a typical liberal democratic thing in which some people get free choice with other people's paychecks. The Section 8 gives rental subsidies, what they call now housing choice vouchers. And it's for a very small, selected group of people that get favored with these, basically these government entitlement to live quite well and not have to work. Because studies have shown that the receiving Section 8 decreases people's work levels. I think that the subsidies now are up to $2,500 or $3,000 a month in some places for free rent. And there is a mindset which is bred by this, because Section 8 is not an entitlement program, which means that not everybody who is a low income receives it, but the local housing agencies get to pick and choose. The city of Baltimore had an opening up for its waiting list for Section 8 last October, and take a guess how many people tried to sign up for Section 8 in Baltimore.
Oh, I'd love to know the figure.
Almost a third of the households in the entire city.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yes. And that's on top of almost 10% of the households in Baltimore who are already getting housing welfare. So, but Section 8 is seen as Section 8 is like winning the lottery for folks who are looking to have a very more comfortable lifestyle without working. And it's had a profoundly corruptive impact in a lot of ways. There were lots of protests in Baltimore by even a Democratic senator who said that what was happening with Section 8 was being given to people in public housing projects and so that they could move elsewhere. And the Democratic senator said there that what HUD may be doing is getting rid of vertical ghettos and creating horizontal ghettos, because there's been a great deal of crime associated with Section 8. There were studies that show that the homicide rate goes up when Section 8 residents move in. There was a HUD-funded study which found that young boys in Section 8 families that move to certain places are far more likely to commit crimes, especially property crimes. It's been a fiasco on many different levels.
Well, a really controversial aspect of it is that, of course, you're accused of racism, naturally, accused of racism for existing, but
sure,
for being opposed to this program, because what you're really saying is you don't want to have black neighbors. Because part of this, because your article was called Clinton's Wrecking Ball for the Suburbs. And the idea was that we're going to take these people, we're going to spread people who are recipients of Section 8 rental subsidies, we're going to spread them out all over the place. And I've got this quotation here. Cisneros said that the Chicago families, referring to people in this Chicago program that gave these people's Section 8 vouchers, the Chicago families have been good neighbors and have been accepted by these communities. But you go on to say, but Section 8 merely redistributed murder from public housing projects to new neighborhoods, according to an analysis published the following decade in the academic journal Homicide Studies. HUD's expatriates soon became notorious for violence across the Midwest. Well, no one's allowed to point that out, but that might help to account for why people were not in favor of this program. It's not that they're against free and open housing choice. If somebody can pay for his house, welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah, and Section 8 has been linked to crime for decades. I did a story, I guess, about in late May for USA Today on the role of HUD, public housing, and Section 8 in helping pave the way to the Baltimore riots, because HUD has had a huge impact in Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, and they have created these areas of impunity, crime with impunity. There was a HUD study in the, 1979, which admitted that in one large public housing project in Baltimore, that the crime rate was 20 times the national average, 20 times. And there's a huge spillover effect. So you had to have a project, and it would end up dragging down the neighborhoods around it. And what HUD would do is they might bulldoze one project, but then they give Section 8 vouchers. Folks would move to other neighborhoods, and sometimes those neighborhoods would be dragged down. A huge part of the trouble is that HUD is not willing to use sound management over the people who get the government subsidies. So you don't have the normal incentive that a property owner would have to be very careful that his property is being maintained.
Well, the book we've been discussing is Public Policy Hooligan, Rollicking and Wrangling from Helltown to Washington. We're going to link to it on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/436. And of course, you can go directly to Amazon to get it, but tomwoods.com/436 will have links related to this particular episode. It is always your trusty companion to each of the episodes of this show. Well, Jim, it's been great chatting. Of course, we're just scratching the surface of what's in this book, but as I say, always leave them wanting more, right? Leave them wanting to go out and get their copy for fantastic summer reading of Public Policy Hooligan. Thanks again.
Hey, thanks so much, Tom.
All right, everybody. Check out James Bovard at jimbovard.com. Of course, we're linking to that on the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/436. Tomorrow, we turn our attention to the Republican nomination process. We're going to talk about Rand Paul and foreign policy with Brian Daugherty of Reason Magazine, the author of a very interesting article on just that subject. Remember also to sign up for my unobtrusive and even helpful weekly letter, and also get my free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, by texting the word LIBERTY to 33444. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.